From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Film Week. Welcome, I'm Larry Mantle.
Better wait a minute. You better hold the phone. Better mind your manners. Better change your tone.
This week, I'm with critics Peter Rayner, Claudia Puig, and Charles Solomon. First up, the Peruvian drama Song Without a Name. It's the story of an indigenous Andrean woman whose newborn is taken from her. Also, the Guatemalan horror movie La Llorona mixes political critique and the supernatural. And the documentary Howard profiles the gifted lyricist Howard Ashman, whose scores include the animated Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, and live-action Little Shop of Horrors. You're listening to Levi Stubbs from Little Shop right now. It's Film Week after NPR News. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app or via podcast wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I'm joined this week by critics Claudia Puig, who's the president of the LA Film Critics Association, Peter Rayner of the Christian Science Monitor, and Charles Solomon of Animation Scoop and Animation Magazine. Our first film up this week is the Peruvian drama Song Without a Name from Melina León, the director and co-screenwriter of the film. Let's start with Peter on Song Without a Name.
This is a really powerful movie. It's directed by Melina León and co-written with Michael White. It's about Georgina, who is played by an indigenous, she's an indigenous Andean woman. I believe the actress is also, indigenous and of limited theatrical experience, but marvelous in the movie, Pamela Mendoza. So she's around 20 and she lives with her husband in a kind of outlying Andes community, in a wooden hut. And she's heavily pregnant. She's sells potatoes in a local market, and she hears on the radio that there's a free natal care that's provided to women in a radio ad. So she, when she is about to deliver, she hurries there and delivers a baby girl. The baby is immediately taken away from her, supposedly to check on the baby's health. But then the mother, Georgina, is sort of, you know, peremptorily take it away from the clinic and separate it from her baby, and she realizes pretty early on that something is very much amiss here, and she's distraught and torn apart by it. And the early scenes where this really dawns on her at night is absolutely heartbreaking, and I think the most powerful scenes of any movie I've seen all year. She and her husband attempt to go to government authorities to see what's going on, you know, with the kidnapping, and get nowhere. She eventually goes to a local newspaper, and one of the reporters there latches onto her story, Pedro, it goes on from there. It's set in 1988, during a time of great political unrest there with the Shining Path, communist terrorists, and so forth. The film could use more context in terms of what's, you know, surrounding the story itself. But it's so beautifully shot. It's a traditional music in the Andes community is part of the soundtrack and the drama in the film. Some of it reminded me of the best parts of Roma. There's a sort of folklore quality, but it doesn't aestheticize the pain that these people are going through, which is something that sometimes happens in these films, you know, beautifully composed scenes, but, somehow too beautiful. But that doesn't happen here. And just as a side note, the film is dedicated to Melina León's father, who was a newspaper a reporter who tracked down a real life kidnapping story, which this film to some.
Oh, wow.
Done.
Melina León, the director and co-screenwriter of Song Without a Name, starring Pamela Mendoza. Claudia?
I agree 100% with Peter. This is a beautiful film. It won 16 awards at film festivals, and rightly so. It also won the best narrative fiction film at Cannes last year. So it has certainly been noticed and deserves to be seen as widely as possible. And it's won at festivals ranging from like Havana to Glasgow to Luxembourg to Jerusalem. It's both personal and poetic, and at the same time, it's about this very high level corruption. It's a kind of a Kafkaesque tale, and yet it's extremely intimate because this is this unimaginable loss that Georgina, endures of losing her baby, and in the way it was done, and the way she is manipulated and fooled. And Pamela Mendoza as Georgina is really wonderful. And I felt like it was very deliberately paced. I loved it. I thought it was, I really sort of escaped into this Andean world. It was very atmospheric and evocative and artful, including the music. There was music on the street and dancing. Her husband is a musician and dancer. And there's some shots that are so gorgeous. They almost look like Ansel Adams. It's a black and white, of course, and they're sort of photographic tableau quality. There's a slightly ethnographic feel to it. It's very solemn, and it's just, it is, you're completely enthralled and enraptured. It's, and I also saw some of the similarities to Roma. There's a scene in which Georgina, the indigenous pregnant woman, is riding in a bus and looking out the window. And it recalls, scenes of Yalitza Aparicio looking through similar windows. It's just strikingly beautiful and very important in what it's saying about corruption in Peruvian society at that time.
Song Without a Name, Peruvian drama, unrated. It's at Lemley's Virtual Cinema, your ability to watch it on that platform. The Guatemalan horror film La Llorona is written and directed by Jairo Bustamante, and the film stars Maria Mercedes Corroy. Claudia, what do you think of La Llorona?
This is another terrific film. It's a good week for Latin American films. This is a Guatemalan film, and Jairo Bustamante did Iscanul last year, or not last year, I'm sorry, 2015. It was the first Guatemalan entry for the what was then called the Foreign Language Oscars, International Oscars now. And this one also won a top prize at the independent competitive section of the Venice Film Festival. What I love about this film is the way it blends genres. It's kind of an alternative horror film, and it's not to be confused with the schlocky Conjuring spinoff that came out last year called The Curse of La Llorona.
Yeah.
We see La Llorona popping up in a lot of ways, and of course the song was sung in Coco. It's a very famous Latin American sort of myth. And what this film does is it's haunting mostly for the its political story, which is about the genocide of thousands of indigenous Guatemalans in the 80s, based on true events. And the general who is charged with these is harking back to a real life general in the 80s. Efrain Rios Montt, who oversaw genocide, that also killed thousands of people, tortured, did all kinds of terrible things. So what this political horror film does is it calls our attention to this heinous period in history. And then it also ties in the ghosts, the ghosts of the disappeared and the people that were killed. And then this sort of layered through with this ghostly story of La Llorona. And it's really well acted too. You have Julio Diaz, who plays the general who actually gets acquitted, and he's demented and horrible, and all these women around him, his wife, his daughter, his granddaughter, who it slowly dawns upon them what he really has been guilty of. And we watch, it's really a film about these women, I think, in patriarchal violence, and we see, how unsettled they become over time, and that's where the ghosts come in. And how they've shielded themselves from the truth and what it takes for them to finally understand. Another really important film, really well acted, beautifully shot. I think the sound design is so powerful. It has all the things you would expect of a horror movie, things that go bump in the night, but in this really much more sophisticated way. So
La Llorona is the film from writer-director Jairo Bustamante. Maria Mercedes Carroy is the star of the film. It's unrated and available on the subscription service for horror and suspense films, Shudder. It's showing La Llorona. We keep an international theme with our third film on Film Week this week, the documentary A Thousand Cuts, which looks at the Duterte regime in the Philippines. The film's written and directed by Ramona S. Diaz. Peter.
Another great movie. This is a documentary, Maria Ressa, a true hero. She is the founder main force behind an online investigative journalism organization called Rappler, which was founded in 2012. It's mostly women who are behind Rappler, which is sort of eye opening in the context of this movie. The extreme bravery that they show in the face of this Duterte regime, which is rules through a sort of macho populism and fear and the politics of hate. Sound familiar? He is very big on assaulting of the free press freedoms, and so she gets quite a bit of blowback for what she does. She's arrested numerous times. Her life is in danger. In general, the so-called war on drugs that Duterte is perpetrating, starting with his regime in 2016, is basically a war on the poor. The director had access to an extraordinary number of people within Rappler, aside from Maria Ressa, as well as some within the Duterte camp, including a sort of Mussolini-like lieutenant nicknamed Balo, and a pop star woman named Mocha. Maria Ressa was one of the four-time Persons of the Year on the cover of Time magazine in 2018, along with Jamal Khashoggi. And she grew up actually in New Jersey, but recamped to the Philippines early on, and chose to go back there even when she didn't have to because of the endangerment. There's a scene in America where she's on a panel with several American journalists, Nicholas Kristof and also George Clooney, and Amal Clooney, his wife, who is one of her defense counsels. One interesting point in the movie I didn't realize was that the Philippines apparently has the highest internet usage of any country in the world per capita, and so some of the anti-press freedom shenanigans that we've been experiencing started out there. The Cambridge Analytica sort of a test case of operations to limit press freedom through fraud and so forth. So it's a fascinating movie on many, many levels.
A Thousand Cuts, the documentary from director Ramona Diaz. Claudia?
Yeah, it's extremely fascinating. The press is so endangered at this moment around the world. And so it's important now more than ever. And this documentary brings that situation into focus by focusing very tightly and training its lens on this amazing crusading journalist, Maria Ressa, who is surprisingly cheerful and sanguine and about going to prison and being sort of enemy number one of Duterte. He says horrible things like she should be publicly raped. I mean, he's just, he's this unhinged dictator and who just threatens her in horrific ways. And she just soldiers on. So if you care about freedom of the press and democracy, it's a film you have to see. I think she is such a hero. And Duterte it's very much a cautionary tale of where, many countries may end up.
A Thousand Cuts is the film from Ramona Diaz, profiling Filipino journalist Maria Ressa. It's unrated. You can see it on Lemle's Virtual Cinema. Let's quickly get started on the documentary Howard, which profiles the tremendous lyricist Howard Ashman, who collaborated with composer Alan Menken on so many great scores of Disney's animated films during their revival period, Little Mermaid, Aladdin, Beauty and the Beast. Charles, please start us off with Howard, the documentary.
Okay, full disclosure, filmmaker Don Hahn is a friend of mine. This is such a good film, I can't resist talking about it. One of my real regrets, there are certain artists I was never able to interview, even when I was writing a great deal about Disney, and Ashman was one of them. By the time I was doing that writing, he was too ill and was staying in upstate New York. But all the artists who worked with him, the story artists, the directors, the voice people, even the executives, all credit him with having been such an important part of that Disney renaissance, that when Little Mermaid came out, with the way the songs were integrated into the story, the way they advanced the story, amazed everyone. The New York Times, I remember, said any Broadway musical would be ecstatic to have a song as good as part of your world, and this film has a number of them.
Let's hold that thought. We'll continue hearing what Charles and Claudia say about the documentary of lyricist Howard Ashman, Howard, from director Don Hahn, who we will interview coming up later this hour on Film Week. It's Film Week on KPCC. So good to have you with us on Film Week on 89.3 KPCC, kpcc.org, and the KPCC app, also available as a podcast wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I'm joined this week by film critics Charles Solomon, Peter Rayner, and Claudia Puig. Charles was just starting us off on the documentary Howard. Don Hahn directed, who also produced a number of these great Disney animated films. Howard tells the story of the lyricist Howard Ashman, who along with Alan Menken came up with the great scores for Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin. And Ashman also, with the wonderful lyrics for Little Shop of Horrors, that first stage adaptation and then the feature film that came out of that. Charles, just a little bit more on what we see about the creative process of Howard Ashman.
Well, that's one of the things that makes this so interesting. We have John Musker, one of the directors of Little Mermaid, talking about going to an apartment in New York and Howard showing up in his leather jacket and just becoming Ariel as he sang that song, the first time they heard Part of Your World. And when Walt made Snow White a musical, he set a pattern that so many American features have followed. But that tradition had really become greatly weakened, and the songs had become insipid, and Ashman really turned that back to what it should be in the beginning, that the songs advance the plot, and they're not things you've heard before, who could give you a lyric like, get out in that square to gawk and grovel and stare, not a list of words you would expect to hear in a song in an animated musical. However, his life was tragically cut short by AIDS just before the opening of Beauty and the Beast, and the film made me cry.
It's just one of so many losses of people in all professions, but the artistic community just hit by so many losses during that period with AIDS. Howard, the documentary that we're talking about. Claudia, what did you think?
Yeah, I had a similar reaction. It definitely moved me to tears. You were asking about the creative process. And one of my favorite scenes is where they're recording Be Our Guest from Beauty and the Beast with Jerry Orbach and Angela Lansbury.
Great scene.
I know. Such a great song. It's like, I defy you not to sing along while you're watching. And Howard and Alan Menken are there, and you know, you can see that they're exhilarated by it. You know, just watching it all come together, and you see him. Someone commented that, you know, his advice was always very specific. It was like, you know, put your emphasis on this word, you know, and he could almost always solve all problems. I mean, some of my favorite lines of all times, I use antlers in all of my decorating, or I'm especially good at expectorating. I mean, the Gaston song is those are only two brilliant lines, but I thought Don Hahn did a beautiful job. You can feel the affection that he has for Howard, definitely. And it's a very moving and richly layered portrait of his contributions and his legacy. He was taken so far too soon. And stylistically, it's interesting because it's kind of a no-frills documentary. We hear a lot of voices talking about him. We never see those people. We don't see his sister. We just hear their voices, and then we get other visuals, which are, you know, archival footage or the creative process itself, which I think is a really interesting way of doing it. Because so many documentaries just show someone sitting there talking. It's a talking head, and it's not particularly interesting. But this, you know, and you go back to his childhood where you see him putting on shows with his toys,
which kind of shows that he was who he was even as a little boy.
Exactly. Oh, absolutely. As a little boy, he went. His mother took him to, a play, a musical theater, and he whispered to her afterwards, "That's what I want to do." And he actually played Aladdin. The film talks about that, and so you know he had a real special spot. And that's another that brilliant song, Prince Ali, which he actually wrote from his hospital bed in his final days. It's just a wonderful documentary and very, very moving.
Howard, about lyricist Howard Ashman. It's unrated on Disney Plus. And again, the director Don Hahn joins me later this hour on Film Week. Spinster, a comedy that's directed by Andrea Dorfman. Jennifer Dial is the screenwriter. Chelsea Peretti stars Claudia.
This is a very kind of low-key but likable, non-traditional rom-com, which is what I appreciate from it. I like the lead performance by Chelsea Peretti, who is in Brooklyn Nine-Nine. That's where people may know her. And she's married to Jordan Peele. You can tell this is written and directed by women. It has very much a woman-centric feel to it. She's a complex character. She's likable. She's wisecracking. She's closing in on 40, and she hasn't found someone to share her life with. But it ends up not being the be-all, end-all for her. It probably never was. And that makes her refreshing in terms of rom-coms because, you know, we don't see much of that. So it's an unconventional journey of self-discovery, you know, told in a comic way. And she... It's well written. It's well acted. It's engaging. It's slight, but it's definitely someone you enjoy spending a couple hours with.
Spinster, Peter.
Yeah, it's minor, but fun. It's a little Alina Dunhamish in places. There's a lot of pretty sharp wisecracks. The Chelsea Peretti character is at one point gets angry at one of the women. You know, who's talking about her biological clock, and so Peretti says, "Well, you know, having babies has a bad effect on the environment. They use up a lot of carbon footprint, or so." She likes being single, or she doesn't dislike not being single. So, I mean, it has a lot of ways in which it goes against what you think it's going for, and that was refreshing. And Peretti's very funny. Also the girl who plays her 10-year-old niece, Adele Nadia Tonin, I thought was quite good.
The film is Spinster. It's a comedy from director Andrea Dorfman. It's unrated and available on several on-demand platforms. The fantasy film Black is King, directed by multiple directors, including Beyoncé. Claudia, what did you think of this Disney Plus streaming film?
Well, I was mesmerized. It's a visually sumptuous feast. It's, you know, the production design, the costumes. I at one point I thought I was going to count the different costume changes, and I realized that I couldn't. It was so, you know, the costumes are just so amazing. I would have loved to have said there were, you know, 3,052, but I don't know. It probably defies counting. More importantly, Beyoncé is making a very powerful statement, telling Black children, you know, that they are wonderfully worthwhile, that encouraging their sense of self-worth and value. You know, it's about Blackness and identity. And it's extremely timely for that reason. It's drawing upon African images. A part of it is shot in Africa. Part of it is shot here. It uses The Lion King as kind of an interstitial or underlying kind of motif. And it does oftentimes feel like a collection of music videos tied together with maybe some nature documentaries. But it is also poetic. To some degree even addresses the civil unrest and the reckoning and galvanizing the Black community. It's based on an album. The music is based on an album that she's already released. Brown Skinned Girl features this panoply of beautiful dark skinned women dancing and singing, including Lupita Nyong'o and so many other famous people. And, you know, it's stunning and it's beautiful. And you feel the wonderful sense of pride, the celebration of being Black. So I love that. And there were a lot of paying tribute to other inspirations. In addition to Julie Dash and Melina Matsoukas, there's Busby Berkeley choreography. That's kind of this Esther Williams swimming scene that's, kaleidoscopic and amazing. And I found it really enjoyable. There's a mystical, metaphysical quality, Afrofuturistic quality. I'm sort of speaking in a patchwork way because that's how this film is. It's scenes and images and poetry all kind of put together. It doesn't have kind of the linear plot that, we're discussing for other films, but I found it quite beautiful and stunning.
Black is King is unrated and it's streaming on Disney Plus. The drama Waiting for the Barbarians is directed by Ciro Guerra. Peter, what'd you think?
It's a mixed bag, but it's worth seeing. It's based on a novel by J.M. Coetzee, who won the Nobel Prize. It's a 1980 novel. It's set in an isolated frontier settlement on the border of a British Empire in the middle of the desert in the early 1900s. It looks like, all of that is a little bit too fuzzy and unspecific. But the main character is a guy named the Magistrate. That's what he's known as, played by a wonderful British actor, of course, Mark Rylance. Won the Oscar for Bridge of Spies, who's in Dunkirk.
Yeah.
And he's a fairly liberal, copacetic guy in this community, brought into it is a Colonel Jal, played by Johnny Depp, who's a real tyrant, and he proceeds to, torture many of the locals and supposedly looking for barbarians who were trying to invade. It all gets to be a bit much, and eventually the magistrate's position is deteriorated to the point where he himself is tortured. It's beautifully shot. Chris Menges, who did Killing Fields, Local Hero, The Mission, he directed A World Apart, does a marvelous job. And there's a kind of Paul Bowles, Graham Greene quality to the best of it. The main reason to see it, I think, is for Mark Rylance's performance.
Waiting for the Barbarians is unrated, and it's on multiple on-demand platforms. The comedy I Used to Go Here, written and directed by Chris Ray. Claudia.
Again, we have another slight indie film that is fun to watch. This one is about a 30-something first-time novelist played by Jillian Jacobs, and she things kind of are going wrong in her life. It seems like a time to celebrate. She's just published her first novel, but her book tour is canceled. Her boyfriend and she have just split up. Her friends are all having babies. She's not. So she feels kind of at loose ends or at odds with her life. And so she gets this invitation to go back to her college to do a reading. So this seems like a wonderful opportunity, kind of go back and show that she, where she's the success she's reached. And instead she goes back and kind of regresses and kind of falls. She goes back to the house that she lived in there and ends up hanging out with these kind of 20 something or kids, college kids. And, they kind of see her as probably an older person, and she thinks she fits right in. And she meets up with her very formative English teacher, who's played by Jermaine Clement. It's always fun to see him from Flight of the Conchords, and it has some really good has a good ensemble cast: Clement, Jorma Taccone, and Gillian Jacobs. And it's kind of interesting because 35 is a weird age. It's, you know, you're not exactly middle aged, but you're not young, and you know you expect to have certain things accomplished by 35, and so it kind of, you know, goes into that territory. It's entertaining. It kind of takes a wrong turn with a particular plot point that feels forced and not very realistic, but it kind of regroups and gets its footing back. So I would say this is, you know, an observant and funny independent film with some really good performances, particularly by Gillian Jacobs, who's very engaging.
I Used to Go Here is unrated on several on-demand platforms. The documentary The Stand, How One Gesture Shook the World, takes us back to the 1968 Mexico Summer Olympic Games. Charles?
Well, of course, 1968 was a terrible time in America. Bobby Kennedy was shot. Martin Luther King was assassinated. Nixon's horrible Vietnam policies were at their height. And there was a growing sense that many Black athletes wanted to introduce some protest or some awareness of the situation into their performances at the Games. And Avery Brundage, who comes across as the real villain in this, was just radically opposed to anything like that, talking about Olympics have nothing to do with this.
It's the head of the International Olympic Committee.
Yes. And then Tommy Smith and John Carlos, after meddling in the sprint, in one of the sprints, did the Black Power salute with black gloves when they were on the podium. And there was a huge scandal, media reaction, discussion, protests, counter-protests, etc. And the filmmakers have talked to Tommy Smith and John Carlos, to some of the people who influenced them. One of the real surprises in the film is that among their most active supporters were the members of the Harvard crew, who felt that they were right to protest and who supported them. And this had grave implications for Smith's and Carlos's future lives. They didn't go back to the Olympics. They had trouble finding work. So it becomes a very timely film. The one real weakness is while they reference Colin Kaepernick at the end, they don't bring him together with Smith and Carlos. And you really would like to see those three men comparing notes.
All right. Tom Ratcliffe, the director of The Stand, How One Gesture Shook the World, unrated documentary on multiple on-demand platforms. You're listening to Film Week on KPCC.
Ariel, listen to me. The human world, it's a mess. Life under the sea is better than anything they got up there. The seaweed is always greener in somebody else's lake. You dream about going up there, but that is a big mistake. Just look at the world around you, right here on the ocean floor. Such wonderful things around you. What more is you looking for? Under the sea.
The great lyrics of the late composer, lyricist Howard Ashman, who is profiled in the new Disney documentary just out from director Don Hahn, Howard, the Howard Ashman story, which takes us back to the developmental years of young Howard Ashman, takes us as well up through his extraordinarily fertile period doing the lyrics for such Disney classic animated films as Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, and Aladdin. Joining us is the director of the documentary, Howard, Don Hahn. Don, thank you for being with us.
Oh, thanks, Larry. It's my pleasure.
So you produced some of the work in which you collaborated with him. And how much of this was a very personal project for you to take someone with whom you collaborated and bring his story to wider attention?
Well, I think it was personal. Part of it is I just worried that Howard's story would get lost. It's been 30 years since we lost him, and there's been no biography or book or a strong piece on him. I wasn't confident at first that I was the person to make it, but then I felt like, well, I do have access to, you know, all the media and all the behind the scenes that we shot and his family. So I dove in, and the result is the film you see today.
What I loved was how we see in Howard Ashman's childhood, him putting on shows for his sister, using his little toys and all. You see how he clearly came into the world as a showman.
He did. You know, and I think a lot of us are that way. You know, we love putting on shows as kids, and somehow we lose that along the way. Well, Howard never lost that. You know, he just got in deeper and deeper, and then of course spent the time to learn his craft and got his master's degree in American musical theater from Indiana University. So it's a combination of somebody who was born to do something, who really put the hours in to absorb himself in it all, and we're all the beneficiaries of that.
Like so many young people right out of college, he comes with his boyfriend and friends from Indiana to Manhattan to try and make a go in the theater world. And when, as is typically the case, you find all these doors that are closed to you unless you have some sorts of ins or connections, he and his small group rent a space upstairs and convert it, this loft, into the WPA Theater. And share with us a little bit about that sort of ability to take something that looks well beyond capability and execute it so effectively.
Yeah, it's remarkable when you think about it, because here's a kid basically in his 20s, right out of university, moves to New York at a time when college students could move to New York and afford it. And part of a, probably very bohemian culture there, where there was a really dynamic creative community, not just of, writers and dramatists, but of actors and musicians. So Howard steps into that and kind of bravely starts his own theater, mostly because he wanted to put on his own work. So it's this little second floor of a warehouse, above a donut shop kind of place, and 99-seat theater. And that's the place, remarkably, where, some of his early work comes from, where he adapted Kurt Vonnegut's book, Rosewater, and where Little Shop of Horrors comes from. So it's an amazing story, but also an amazing time, I think, in New York, where all this kind of dynamic creative culture is coming to town, because large parts of New York are derelict, and you can afford it, and you can go there, and there can be this kind of creative community that was really important at that time.
Don, let's talk about the development of Little Shop of Horrors, because as is made clear in your documentary, Howard, everyone around Ashman thought this was a terrible idea to take this Roger Corman comedic horror film and turn it into a musical. What was it that Ashman saw in that as fodder for his creativity to make it not just a musical, but a spectacle?
Well, he was remarkable at adapting things. And he had seen that movie, as most of us had, as a kid. Little Shop of Horrors is kind of a cult movie when you're 14 years old. And so it was probably something in the back of his mind. But I think the other gift that Howard had was he didn't just adapt it coldly based on what the Corman movie was, but he did these incredible mashups. So he would take Corman's movie and put it with like 1950s girl group rock and roll. And this kind of impossible combination of elements turned out to be Little Shop, and that kind of Dark Side of Greece sound that he and Alan came up with for that. And what's amazing to me is his theater was in this kind of derelict section of Manhattan, kind of Fifth Avenue and 22nd or 21st Street. And yet the glitterati of New York would come down there and to see this show in this little 99-seat theater. And it was a huge, huge cultural event to come down and do that. So I just think it's, again, that kind of artistic bravery, for lack of a better word, that Howard had to be able to put these disparate elements together and make theater out of it. And it was very brave and very successful.
We're talking with Don Hahn, a producer of so many great Disney films over the years, and the director of Howard, the story of Howard Ashman, the Disney lyricist, who just came up with just extraordinary wordplay. But more than that, and you see that in the film, really how his impact went beyond just being a typical lyricist. He had a huge effect as well, even on character development. And Don, we should talk about that with Little Mermaid, the influence that Ashman had on that film's characters.
Yeah, once again, you know, Mermaid was a story that was hashed by Ron Clements and John Musker, the brilliant Disney directors. And yet I think some of the characters were kind of traditional. It's a Danish fairy tale after all. And so Howard comes in and says, well, it's a Danish fairy tale, but what about if we set it in the Caribbean? And so again, he's doing these like crazy mashups and taking characters like Sebastian the Crab, who was, you know, kind of an English majordomo kind of under the sea character, and saying, well, let's make him Jamaican, you know, let's make him a Rastafarian. And he does that so that you can then latch on to all this amazing Caribbean music and you can have the fun and listenability of, you know, calypso and all this kind of music that's connected to the ocean anyway. So it's just another example of many times when he would come in and was a great collaborator, but not afraid to put forward these kind of amazing ideas that would just up the game a lot. He did it on Aladdin again when he came in and just, you know, wrote a whole score that was very kind of Cab Calloway, 1920s Harlem jazz almost, with Alan Menken once again.
And it helps
Beauty and the Beast, which is more operetta. So it's that fearlessness that I admired and tried to put across in the movie with Howard, that fearlessness to just throw out those ridiculous, unmarketable, uncommercial ideas that turned out to be incredibly successful.
Let's hear John Musker, Little Mermaid director, talk about working with Howard Ashman and how Ashman pitched the song Part of Your World.
Howard was involved really early in this project, and we went to New York, met with Howard, and he, just based on the treatment before a script was written, sort of did a placement kind of songs, but I think he had probably written all the songs, you know, 5 minutes after he got the treatment. But he said, now here, say you had a song, let's just say it was called Part of Your World. It could be called anything, but let's just say it was called Part of Your World. And then he and Alan, we were in Howard's apartment in Greenwich Village, and Alan came over and played it on the piano, and Howard sang it and right there, and it sounded great.
John Musker, the director of one of the classics from Disney animation, The Little Mermaid and A Part of Your World, how that song was pitched. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPECC. Let's go back to Howard Ashman's lyrics and the music from Little Shop of Horrors, Suddenly Seymour, this performed by the original 1982 off-Broadway cast.
Clean as the morning, I know things were bad, but now they're okay. Suddenly Seymour is standing beside you.
It's Film Week on KPCC.
Well, Alibaba had them 40 thieves. Sherazade had 1,000 tales. But master, you in luck, cause up your sleeves, you got a brand of magic never fails. You got some power in your corner now. Some heavy ammunition in your camp. You got some punch, pizzazz! Your blue and house, all you gotta do is rub that lamp. And I'll say,
Mr. Aladdin, sir, what will your pleasure be?
Let me take your order, jot it down. You ain't never had a friend like me.
Howard Ashman's great lyrics, Alan Menken's composition, the score from Aladdin, and so creative, the wordplay. And you hear Robin Williams, of course, in that tremendous role as the genie from Aladdin, 1992 Disney feature. We're talking about the new documentary streaming on Disney Plus, directed by Don Hahn, himself Disney producer for a number of films, including The Lion King and Beauty and the Beast. The documentary gives us the life story and creative development of Howard Ashman, the gifted lyricist from Aladdin, Beauty and the Beast, The Little Mermaid, and Little Shop of Horrors. Let's listen to another selection from the film. This, to me, is one of my favorite parts of the documentary, Howard. It's from the recording session of Beauty and the Beast, Be Our Guests. This one of three songs nominated for Best Original Song in 1991 by Howard Ashman. Hear the film's composer, Alan Menken, director Kirk Wise of Beauty and the Beast, talk about what it was like to record the film's soundtrack.
Be our guest. Be our guest. Put our service to the test.
They were incredible. At that session, remember, it was both Jerry Orbach and Angela at the same session. I mean, it was musical theater heaven.
There was just an incredible thrill to be able to walk into that studio in New York and have this full orchestra and this full chorus performing this stuff live. I mean, we created the soundtrack for Beauty and the Beast like a Broadway cast album.
Don Hahn, that's an extraordinary scene. Angela Lansbury is a friend of our program here. Just how you see her and Jerry Orbach just take on these characters. And the response of Ashman and Menken watching this all unfold, a beautiful scene.
Yeah, it's a piece of film that's been sitting there for a while. And to be able to share that in this documentary is a chance to kind of get insight into not just Howard, but his relationship with actors. He loved actors and had a vocabulary for dealing with them that was really special. He was very specific, very collaborative, and was really able to take such trained, such amazing professionals as Jerry Orbach and as Angela, and you know, get them into these characters in a really special way. And I wanted to put that on the screen. I think at its best, documentaries are kind of voyeuristic and allows you to be a fly on the wall in places where you never thought you could be. And so to be able to just let that run for a while and sit there and watch that session is revelatory. It just lets you see not only the kind of fun and the energy and the you know, amazing day that was, but just see Howard work. And that's part of what I wanted the documentary to be, is not just a biography, but also have it be instructive, because I think there's so much interested in musicals now and so many amazing people working in musicals. I think it's fascinating to see their process, and Howard's process was fantastic.
And Don, you know, so often with people who are gifted at the level of Howard Ashman, they're so intent on their vision being carried out that they can dominate the people around them. And that may well have been in part, you know, some of Howard Ashman, he did have a very clear vision. But how did the people who collaborated with him respond to his presence and to his ideas?
Well, I think you have to put yourself in the 80s when he showed up at the studio. We were a really young group of filmmakers. You know, you heard John Musker and Ron Clements, people like Brad Bird or Tim Burton. We were all at the studio trying to prove that we could make animated films too, like Walt Disney did. Whether we did or not, I don't know. But I feel like into that mix, which was a time of, you know, kind of a young, hungry studio, with some brilliant directors like Jeffrey Katzenberg and Michael Eisner at the studio at the time, into that was Howard kind of threw a match into that gas tank, so to speak. And so it was a perfect storm of all those elements that came together. He was very opinionated. He was difficult sometimes, but so were we. You know, I think we had to push back. But the thing about Howard is he was so articulate and so clear about what he wanted that you better bring your A game. You better show up in the morning with an equally articulate defense to what his offense was in terms of ideas. And he would listen. He was smart. He was funny. He was collaborative. So, you know, it was challenging, but we welcomed it so much, because imagine walking through the halls of our little studio, which was a warehouse in Glendale, and hearing Alan Menken on the piano and Howard singing in the room next door, these songs on Little Mermaid.
And you knew they were great even at the time, I assume. You realized the talent here.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It was in the air.
Finally, we have to talk about his illness, because he left us at 39, like so many tremendous people in the arts, all professions, but the arts, of course, so hard hit by AIDS. And what was it like there at the end as he was trying to, you know, continue to work, but in tremendously diminished physically?
Well, it's, you know, obviously bittersweet. It's a story of this kind of artistic heroism. He didn't stop working. And you know, in the room, we never talked about it. We never had a day when we sat down and he told us about how tired he was or anything else. It was always about the work in a really positive way. And so I think the work, in a way, was a chance for him to buffer some of the things he was going through in his personal life. And this epidemic, of course, was taking out the creative community and, you know, in Broadway and Hollywood, and it was devastating. So it wasn't just Howard, but he was watching his friends and colleagues being taken out by the AIDS crisis. So he kept working. You know, he was writing songs like Friend Like Me in Aladdin from his hospital bed. We were recording songs for Beauty and the Beast over the telephone when he hardly had a voice to be able to speak. So incredibly persistent and heroic, but talk about the triumph of the human spirit. Boy, he was able to hang in there and do his work in a positive way that I certainly couldn't do, and I think few of us could.
Don, in closing, I want to ask about you, because you were a boy from Burbank, right? Your family moved there when you were a teenager, and I mean, you at this point in your career, producing these Disney classics, still as a producer, creating great content for Disney with nature films. Hard for you to believe that you came from the city where Disney Studios were, and this whole career working with Disney.
Yeah, you know, I am a local boy and proud of it. And, you know, I would say, gee, my dreams came true, but I never dreamed I'd be doing this, you know. I guess the thing is, I always admired Walt Disney. I always admired his story and his persistence and his vision. And I'm no Walt Disney, but I just felt like he was able to pull a group of creative people around him to create some amazing things in the world, and films and theme parks and things. And I thought, if I could do that as a living, how great would that be? And so my job really is to, you know, find the best people I can, and then do exactly what they tell me to do, you know, to gather these amazing groups of people around. And I've been lucky to do that. I've been lucky to work with people like Howard and Alan and so many great animators and artists, yeah, and directors. And if I can pull those people together and make something that's entertaining and uplifting and, you know, put some entertainment out into the world, what a great life that is.
And you've certainly done it. Don Hahn, the director of the documentary Howard on Howard Ashman, streaming on Disney+. From all of us at Film Week, have a great weekend.